The Iowa Arts Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. While the leaves are ablaze and the fall harvest progresses, the Iowa arts scene is kicking into high gear. For October and early November, we applaud as the Southeast Iowa Symphony Orchestra celebrates their 65th anniversary. We'll zip to Iowa City to get the latest scoop on Hancher's projected 2016 spring opening. We'll discover what performances the Dubuque Symphony has scheduled for their upcoming season. We'll catch up with an award-winning documentarian as she prepares to head to Iowa. We'll see how Iowa State University's music and theater departments are pulling together to present Mozart's The Magic Flute. And we'll hear about the Iowa Composers Forum's fall vocal concert offerings. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
I hope our younger generation will really start to take note of the Iowa Composers Forum. They've been instrumental in supporting me as an artist. I kind of fell into new music when I was in graduate school because I could sing it and I could read it and I liked it. But it's been such an education for me. I've enjoyed so much getting to know composers, and I've learned a lot from this process, and it's helped me grow as an artist. So I thank them for that.
We just hope that we're exposing more people to a new genre of music, and we're really excited for the concert, and we hope that a whole new audience of people will learn to appreciate emerging works.
Associate Professor of Voice and Director of Opera Theater at Drake University, Dr. Ann Crivero, and Drake University's collaborative pianist and Drake Community School of Music faculty member, Jessica Anderson. The ICF's chair, Dr. Brooke Joyce, contacted Ann about a call for vocal scores. Ann and Jessica selected six scores from a pool of applicants. The fall concert opens with four songs by Dr. Jerry Owen.
These poems that Jerry set are based on poems by William Blake, which was a set of about 26 poems that form the second part of his Songs of Innocence and Experience. And they're full of emotional extremes, and they serve as dramatic scenarios and very well suited for the mezzo-soprano voice.
The piano part is really interesting. At first, when I was learning it, it felt like I was almost getting lost in the complication, in the intricacy, and how it's so full of embellishments and these really interesting harmonies. But the more I worked with it, the more I really fell in love with it. And it is a beautiful piece, very exquisite. And I think the audience will really enjoy the sound that he's produced. Really exquisite writing.
And then you go to a cycle of love songs.
Yeah, these songs are by a composer, Jonathan Wilson. He's currently studying at the University of Iowa. And he based this music on the poetry of Sarah Teasdale. So she was an American lyric poet from Missouri. And the poems were selected to tell, according to the composer, a much larger story. A story about a woman whose wisdom of love deepens from song to song. So I begin with high-spirited, optimistic, confident, and carefree. And as the cycle progresses, she or I become more cynical and skeptical of the world around her. So it's a very well-written work. There's a lot of memorable melodic lines, I think, that you can almost go away humming after you hear. So I think the audience is really going to enjoy this work.
I agree with everything Anne said. I've enjoyed the piano part, not quite as complicated, maybe, as the Owen, but it is difficult in its own way, but also very fun.
And then Dr. Brooke Joyce has a work.
Yeah, this work by Dr. Joyce is based on the Italian poet and novelist Umberto Saba, and it's very sentimental. It's a romantic work. It's very modern in its composition. It's a very tight type of compositional style. And actually, Dr. Joyce first wrote this song. The first song was produced in Decorah. He composed that in Decorah. And the second one and third were composed in a village on the Adriatic coast in Italy. So he created this very beautiful and very challenging vocal work.
And the next is a world premiere.
Chase Shoemaker is a composer from Sioux City, Iowa. He's currently studying at Simpson College, where he's working on his Bachelor of Music in Education. And primarily, he focuses on sacred choral works, but this work is actually secular. It's very tonal, includes lovely melodic lines, and I think it's important that ICF is so encouraging to their young composers.
Tell us about this next composer and the works you're going to be performing of his.
Robert Sarri actually sent me a packet of music that landed in my mailbox, and I love it. It's like Christmas for me, and I immediately fell in love with these compositions. The melodies are so beautiful. Some people have said that his compositional style is maybe somewhat like Copland in his vocal works and the approach. The poetry grabbed me as well. We have Rain Has Fallen, and also Remember Me from Venus and Adonis. So some of these classical texts that are set in a very modern and real way today.
These are simply beautiful pieces, and I find myself hearing the melodies throughout the day, even when I'm not rehearsing them. And they're very lovely, and they evoke a lot of emotion when I'm playing them. They're the kind of pieces, I think, that make you feel something from your heart.
And tell us about the last work on the concert.
This work, Will-O-Wisp, is by composer Ralph Kendrick. And Ralph is currently living in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He composes in a variety of genres, works for orchestra, choir, chamber groups, and solo musicians. This work, it's just a gleeful piece. It captures the very meaning of the title. It's dotted rhythmic motifs, shifting meters, ascending vocal lines. It all emulates this sense of like an elusive goal or a light that sometimes appears over the ground at night. It's a fun piece. We're actually ending the set with Will-O-Wisp.
Exciting program ender.
Yeah, it is.
So why is it important to do new music?
You know, I think of performing new music as a twofold responsibility as an artist. First, I think it's really important to support my colleagues in their creative process, particularly with respect to works that involve the voice. And then secondly is to draw awareness to the compositional styles for voice that are happening now. You know, when I'm involved in this collaborative process of singing new music and premiering new works, I'm very much reminded how alive classical music is today and in our society. And I think it's so important, especially for the youth of our generation, to get involved with organizations like ICF. ICF has opened so many doors for me and have been so supportive.
It's very fun to premiere new music because with a lot of more standard works, you do sometimes feel like there's a precedent for how to perform it. But when you are performing new music, it's very fresh and it's exciting to be able to feel like you have a lot of creative liberty to work together with the composer and kind of implement their vision for the music. But it's really an honor, and we really hope to do justice to the pieces that have been written. And I agree with Anne, it's been a good experience for me. It has stretched me, but at the end of the day, it's just really fun to do new music and to celebrate creativity.
Associate Professor of Voice and Director of Opera Theater at Drake University, Dr. Anne Crivero, and Drake University's Collaborative Pianist and Drake Community School of Music faculty member, Jessica Anderson. The Iowa Composers Forum will be hosting two performances of their 2015 fall program. On Saturday, October 24th, you can enjoy the concert at the Opus Concert Cafe in Cedar Rapids, and again on Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Des Moines Social Club. Tickets will be available at the door. For more details, go to iowacomposers.org. Just ahead, we'll hear about Hanscher's new 2015-16 season. We'll enjoy learning about the Dubuque Symphony's concert lineup. We'll investigate a career transition from lawyer to documentarian. We'll see how a magic flute and bells can save your life. And we'll learn about the Blue Sapphire anniversary season of the Southeast Iowa Symphony. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
The orchestra has been around for 65 years in a fairly rural area. So we have three boards, Ottumwa, Iowa, Mount Pleasant, and Burlington. But we have people from adjoining communities, Washington, Fairfield, Keokuk, Fort Madison, that belong to those boards. But we perform our main classical set in those three areas. And The orchestra really developed its structure under Dr. Ruth Krauss at Iowa Wesleyan College over about a 20 to 25-year period in the 60s and 70s. But the orchestra started as just a bunch of amateurs needing an outlet, getting together in the 1950s. And it's really progressed to being a very good regional community orchestra.
The Southeast Iowa Symphony Orchestra's conductor and music director, Robert McConnell. With three operating boards and a governing board, along with collaborations and some funding from Iowa Wesleyan, Indian Hills, and Southeast Community Colleges, plus overwhelming community support, the Southeast Iowa Symphony draws on musicians within a 90-mile radius.
We depend on people donating money. You depend on volunteers organizing and making the logistics happen. In our case, we basically operate with a manager and a conductor and then everybody else. Well, we're all part-time. And then you've got your musicians that you depend on. So when you put all those things together, it's a lot of parts that have to be good for a good arts organization. And certainly the volunteers and the people that donate money are a huge part of it.
So tell us about your classical concert series that you have set up for this year.
The Southeast Iowa Symphony typically presents three sets of classical concerts during the year, and that's only a portion of what we do because we do a lot of educational outreach and kids' concerts and other special concerts, too. But we consider the classical concerts kind of our reason for existence, and typically we'll do a set in October, one in February, and one in March. Usually, I would say on the fall concert, we frequently have a guest artist. This year we don't. We've got a really nice mix of a program, I think. A lot of people have heard of Arnold Schoenberg, and they think of his music as more avant-garde, but Schoenberg was a huge admirer of a variety of music, particularly J.S. Bach, and he decided the Prelude and Fugue in E-flat, the St. Anne's Prelude and Fugue, was too much music, and he wanted to take it from the organ and put it into full orchestra. And it is really a cool arrangement, and we're really looking forward to that. Sibelius's Corellia Suite is a neat set of three pieces that he put together. And then also on that program, Ravel Alvarado del Grazioso. It's a wonderful, vibrant piece, very unusual. And then we end the program with Mendelssohn's Fifth Symphony. And the really neat thing about this piece is he makes use of the hymn tune, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and does it in such a fantastic setting. So this is an all-orchestra concert without any soloists or anything, but it's got a lot of variety. We try to program things that people are going to enjoy. Let's say that you're a husband that's been dragged along to a concert by your wife. You're still going to find some things on that program you really enjoy. There's so much variety and that sort of thing. The winter concert is a little unusual for us. We do feature a guest artist, but it's always our young artist competition winner. And the first Saturday in December each year, we hold a competition at Iowa Wesleyan College for high school and younger students from a 19-county Southeast Iowa area to audition to perform with the orchestra. And they will perform on our February concert. But the entire rest of the program is Mahler's Symphony No. 5. Now, that's a big work for a community orchestra. And in our case, our problem is we do two concerts on one day. So on a Sunday, we'll play in Ottumwa in the afternoon and Mount Pleasant at night. But part of our mission is to provide performing opportunities for musicians in our region. And most of them, unless you're playing in a big orchestra, you're not going to have a chance to do Mahler 5. So we try to do a major work like that every season, every two seasons. And the spring concert in March, we have a visiting artist, Will Baker. I think he plays with Orchestra Iowa and Des Moines Symphony occasionally. He's a Chicago-based trombonist. And he's going to be featured on several pieces, one at least for bass trombone. And then we're also doing Schumann Symphony No. 4 and the great Janacek Symphonietta. That's wonderful brass feature, kind of a brass theme to the whole concert. So those are our three classical concerts.
just briefly outline your chamber concert, and you have one in over the holidays, and then you have another one in May.
Several years ago, we had some requests from people in the area for chamber music, and particularly in one location down near Kyoto, Harper, Iowa, and they had saved a church that was due for demolition. So that was the impetus for us starting to do more chamber concerts, and since then we've gone on, and we try to do them in communities that don't get our classical series. So we'll be doing another one near Harper, Iowa. We'll be doing a community concert in Washington, Iowa in May. That same concert we'll be doing in Burlington also. At the same time, we started doing a holiday concert several years ago, and that's December 12th at Iowa Wesleyan, and we basically collaborate with area vocalists and some bell choirs, this sort of thing, and put on kind of a variety holiday concert. And I think the only thing I haven't told you about is that we do a kids' concert on Saturday, November 14th. And we do this concert three times in one day, Ottumwa, Mount Pleasant, and then Burlington, about a 45-minute concert. And this year, it's based off one of the Dr. Seuss stories, and it's done with orchestra and soprano. So it's a really neat program.
The Southeast Iowa Symphony's conductor and music director, Robert McConnell. Congratulations to this orchestra as they celebrate their 65th successful anniversary season. To get more details about their concerts, please see their website at seiso.org. Don't go away. Music director and conductor Maestro William Intrilligator shares details on the Dubuque Symphony's new season lineup. Two in-depth documentaries will soon be screened at UNI. Iowa State University presents Mozart's classic opera, The Magic Flute, and the new Hancher Auditorium opens next spring. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. Since the flood of 2008, this will be the last year that Hancher will have to host their season without an auditorium. For the past 8 years, the Iowa City, Coralville, and Riverside communities have stepped up to the plate, opening their venues in generous collaboration with Hancher. Keeping with their Something for Everyone theme, Hancher has scheduled a broad range of events for their new season. Hancher's executive director, Charles Swanson.
I want to first of all just say that we're grateful to all of our community partners over the years for sharing their spaces with us. It's been an amazing experience. So on Saturday, October 17th, we will present the Brentano String Quartet. And this is a magnificent string quartet. And the Brentano String Quartet will be in residence at Hancher and at the University of Iowa for a week. They were the resident company for many years at Princeton University. And I know now they're in residence at Yale University, succeeding the Tokyo String Quartet. We are presenting them in collaboration with the University of Iowa String Quartet in Residence program, which is just a wonderful collaboration. So they will be teaching University of Iowa music students in various classes during the week. And then on October 14th, they're going to be presenting a very interesting program. It's called Under the Hood. And at this program, they will share behind-the-scenes discussion as to how they have built a career as an internationally recognized quartet. And then on the same day, they will also do a program at the Frank Conroy Reading Room at the Day House, and this will be open to the public. And their concert will be in Riverside Recital Hall on October 17th. And then on October 30th, we will present a Club Hancher event, and this is a very intimate setting at The Mill in Iowa City. The title of this event is You Know How I Feel, and this will be with three female artists, Lynn Ariel on piano, Carla Cook as a vocalist, and Grace Kelly on saxophone. Their program actually celebrates three legends in jazz who inspired these three women, Nina Simone, Abby Lincoln, and Joni Mitchell. And we're going to have two showings, one at 7 and one at 9:30. And then we have somebody who's everybody has heard of, Grammy Award winner Chris Thiele, who will be at the Englert. He is a Hancher artist performing on November 4th. He shares his music with the beautiful sound of the mandolin. and he's also a singer and a songwriter. His program will be varied, but will include some of his own works. People will remember him performing with Nickel Creek and with the Punch Brothers. Taylor Mack. Taylor Mack is an artist who is new to Hancher. He will be performing at Maybe Theater on December 5th. And his performance is certainly one of a kind. He is an actor, he's a playwright, he's a singer, a songwriter, and he performs in drag. He calls himself a radical fairy, and Taylor Mack is actually creating a piece of work that will review, get this, 24 decades of popular music from 1770 to the 2010s. 240 years of popular music. Hancher has commissioned the 1850s, which will be an evening of Walt Whitman and Stephen Foster. And then Ellis Marsalis Quartet. They will be performing a holiday show at the Englert. This is on December 11th. And Ellis Marsalis is a very famous American jazz pianist. He's a patriarch to those famous Marsalis musicians. He's one of the leading educators also in jazz in New Orleans and throughout the country, and he has influenced the lives of many of the great jazz musicians. And Vocalocity, this is an amazing a cappella group. They will be performing on January 30th at the Englert. Their program will be very lively and full of enthusiasm with lots of interaction and lots of movement on stage. And then to end our season, we are going to end this with one of the greats, Bobby McFerrin, who is an American vocalist and a conductor and really one of the all-time greats. His performance will be on February 12th at Riverside Casino and Golf Resort. And Bobby McFerrin is a multiple Grammy Award winner, I think almost 10 times. And he shares a sound that is truly one of a kind, a very, very unique voice techniques. His concerts are always very unusual, always memorable, and this one will be especially memorable because it will be our last performance without a building. And for those of you who don't know Bobby McFerrin, which I think most people do, but he was the one who created the hit song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. And I think that's quite fitting. And then I have to share something. In November, we are actually going to be traveling through the state and presenting a play that Hancher commissioned last season called Out of Bounds. This is a play about cyberbullying. It's a play by Working Group Theater. And we're trying to reach out to these young people and really show them through the arts how cyberbullying can really hurt others. And so we worked with the University of Iowa College of Public Health, and I'm proud to say that we are presenting this play to middle schools and hopefully making a difference in the lives of these young people. So you might say that this is a shorter season than most, and it is. And we did that for a reason. We want to prepare for our move into the new building. We're on schedule. Should be done towards the latter part of March, first part of April. We will be setting up our box office, our showcase, our cafe. It will be a busy time, but also a very exciting time. I love, though, because I hear from people who say they have driven by Hancher lately, and everybody seems to be happy with what they see. And of course, the best is yet to come. And there are so many ways that people can purchase Hancher tickets. You can call the box office, 1-800-HANCHER. You can go to the website, which is hancher.uiowa.edu. Or if you live close to Iowa City or are driving through, you can go directly to the box office in the old Capitol Mall. And the box office is opened Monday through Friday from 10 to 5:30.
Hancher's Executive Director, Charles Swanson. Hancher's new auditorium is slated for completion next spring. Hancher will announce their 2015-16 season in April of next year, with their new opening season starting in September. Just ahead, UNI's Chloe C. documentary film series hosts an award-winning filmmaker. ISU's theater and music departments collaborate to present one of Mozart's greatest operas. And the Dubuque Symphony kicks off their new season. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. The Dubuque Symphony's 57th season opens on October 10th and 11th. For the past 16 years, Maestro William Intrilligator has served as music director and conductor.
We're very excited for the Dubuque Symphony Orchestra's 2015-2016 classic series. We will begin with one of the great works of the repertoire, Berlioz's Symphony Fantastique, on our opening classics concert in October. And also on that program, we have Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and a brand new work written by Dubuque composer Amy Dunker, an opening fanfare, if you will. And we're very excited to be presenting these concerts in the relatively new concert hall, the Heritage Center at the University of Dubuque.
And tell us just a bit about this world-class pianist that you have coming.
Oh, she's amazing. Natasha Prinsky, she is already performing with many of the great orchestras around the world, really. And I feel very fortunate that we were able to bring her to Dubuque. And she is Russian, and she will be performing this great Russian concerto. And it's going to be a very, very special performance because of her.
Tell us about your magical Mozart concert.
The concert in November, it's November 14th and 15th, our second classics concert. As bookends for this concert, we have two works by Mozart, his Overture to the Marriage of Figaro, and his Symphony No. 40, that G minor, such a fantastic masterpiece. In between, we have an unusual combination. We have Haydn's Trumpet Concerto. Of course, Haydn and Mozart go very well together. We're excited to feature Wes Skigel, our principal trumpet, in that concerto. But we're also going to be showcasing the strings of the orchestra in the third movement of Philip Glass's Symphony No. 3. This is gorgeous, hauntingly, mesmerizingly beautiful music written by Philip Glass, and I'm very excited to introduce this to our classics audiences for the first time.
And this concert is going to be held at the Five Flags Theater?
That's correct. That's one concert where we're going back to Five Flags Theater in downtown Dubuque.
And tell us about your next concert in your classics series.
Actually, we have a little bit of a break, and it's not until March. On March 5th and 6th, we partner with the Dubuque Chorale and soprano Emily Bursan and baritone Ashraf Sawalian to present Brahms' masterpiece, A German Requiem, the Ein Deutsches Requiem by Brahms. One of my all-time favorite pieces, really like one of my desert island pieces. It's so gorgeous, it's so beautiful, it's so meaningful. And paired with the Brahms, as a first half, we have Beethoven's wonderful Symphony No. 1, the very first symphony of Beethoven.
And that performance of your Classics 3 is also at the Five Flags Theater.
That's right.
Now you're going to really kind of switch gears a bit. Tell us about your Classics 4 concert.
Our Classics 4 concert brings us back to the Heritage Center at the University of Dubuque campus. And for this one, the orchestra will be in the pit as we present a fully staged ballet of the classic ballet Giselle with the Heartland Ballet Company, which is right there located in Dubuque and with whom we've partnered many times. And Giselle is one of the great ballets, and we're very excited to be able to perform this, and particularly to be able to do it at the Heritage Center, where the full orchestra can fit in the large pit, and then we can have full sets and costumes and so forth.
Tell us about your fantastic last Classics 5 concert.
Well, we're very excited to be bringing the great violinist Midori to Dubuque. The orchestra has applied for a grant to bring her to work with the orchestra as well as our youth orchestra. And so Midori will be in residence in Dubuque for the week leading up to these concerts on May 7th and 8th. And she has agreed to play the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto with the Dubuque Symphony Orchestra on our final classics concerts. And those will be again at Five Flags Theater. And rounding out the program, we have an all-time favorite of audiences, Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, the New World Symphony.
Now, you have some other concerts that will be part of your season, but they aren't part of the classic seasons. Just briefly fill us in on those.
We have our annual holiday concerts. We have two full-length holiday concerts, a Saturday evening, December 5th, and Sunday afternoon, December 6th, where we partner with the Dubuque Chorale, some members of the Heartland Ballet, and we will be presenting guest soloist soprano Diane Penny. We also have a shorter family version of that concert, which is on Saturday afternoon, December 5th. And that's a wonderful program for kids of all ages, and that's been very popular. So we have our holiday concerts. We also, in January, have what's become an annual tradition for us now. We partner with local rock band musicians, and we have the symphony and this rock band play together a concert of rock and roll hits at a very unusual venue, which is the Mississippi Moon Bar. It is a bar, but it's actually a concert venue within the Diamond Joe Casino in Dubuque. And it's an amazing evening of energy and excitement and lots of familiar rock and roll pieces as you're used to hearing them, but amplified with the wonderful musicians of the symphony as well. And then we also have our educational concerts for kids, which occur this fall. We have concerts of our youth ensemble. The Dubuque Symphony Orchestra is the parent organization for three training orchestras, and they have their own concert season as well. And as I mentioned earlier, the Youth Symphony will be performing with Midori when she is here in Dubuque with us in May 2016. And then we also have our summer concert. We have a free concert that we do in June at the Dubuque Arboretum and Botanical Gardens. It's just a wonderful, magical evening. And I believe in 2016, that concert will be on Sunday evening, June 26th.
Maestro William Intrilligator, music director and conductor of the Dubuque Symphony. On the Fridays before each classics concert, Maestro Intrilligator and the orchestra's guest artist join forces at the Dubuque Country Club for a very popular, lively, and fun lecture luncheon called Soundbites. To find out more details and purchase luncheon and orchestra concert tickets, please go to dubuquesymphony.org or call 563-557-1677. Don't go away. ISU's theater and music departments collaborate to present a classic Mozart opera. And UNI's Cloacy documentary film series presents two prize-winning films. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I think documentary kind of allows you to experience life experiences that you may not have had. And I think it encourages you to be a human being with connections to other human beings. And sometimes that's hard. But if you can see yourself in the place of some of these people, and I think that's what the films I really like, they allow you to do that.
Guest documentary filmmaker Don Porter. The University of Northern Iowa's Cloacy documentary film series is bringing Dawn Porter to Iowa for the screening of two of her films. UNI will screen Gideon's Army on October 5th and Spies of Mississippi on October 6th. Dawn grew up in New York City, graduated from Swarthmore, and received her law degree from Georgetown. For 5 years, she practiced law in D.C., She then served as a lawyer for the news division of ABC TV in New York and followed that with the same job at A&E TV. Her film, Gideon's Army, takes an inside look at the U.S. legal system.
I was introduced by a person who's now a really dear friend, and she was working for the Ford Foundation in their criminal justice group, and she introduced me to Jonathan Rapping from what is now Gideon's Promise. And John was a public defender, and then he did training of public defenders, and he had gone to work in post-Katrina New Orleans to train public defenders and to really redesign that public defender office. And he invited me to his training program. He has what's now a pretty famous training program. It's kind of like lawyer public defender boot camp, and people come for 2 weeks, and they do not only skills training, but really what they're doing is community building. And because they are sending out public defenders to places where they may not have a lot of support. So a lot of what he does is support brand new lawyers. So all of them have less than 3 years of experience. Some of them have just taken the bar. They have no experience. And it was a really transformative experience. I saw these lawyers and they were talking about justice and they were talking about the Constitution. And I thought, this is just so remarkable. Whatever I thought a public defender was, I did not think it was this. And then I just asked for volunteers and then kind of got to know some of the different lawyers. And, you know, we kind of grew together, and people who were willing to let me follow them, the stories kind of grew out of that relationship.
You won several major awards for this film as well. Tell us about those.
Thank you. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2013, and it won the award for best editing there. And then it was on HBO. It was one of their higher rated documentaries that season. It was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award and nominated for an Emmy Award and won the Reidenhauer Prize, which I'm very, very proud of, a prize for journalism that illuminates justice issues. And even though I'm a lawyer, I felt like I knew nothing about the criminal justice system from the perspective of people who are trying to work within it and do what's right. And so, you know, that's kind of how I approached it. I think we all know what a bad public defender is. And if you ask 9 out of 10 people, they'd say they would never want a public defender. That may not be true in San Francisco, though, where I live now, because there's a spectacular public defender office here. And I certainly don't think every public defender is great. I don't think, you know, you can generalize that way. But I do think that a lot of them are really kind of unsung in how dedicated they are to their work. And so what I wanted to kind of explore was, what if you want to do a good job? What does that feel like? And what kind of emotional stressors are there on you when you're trying to do a good job in a really difficult system that is not set up for you to do your best? And so I think people respond to something that is not, it's not a big noisy film, it's a quiet film. But I think that you can see yourself, everybody has had a struggle about something that they care about. And you watch these young lawyers struggle. And Jonathan Rapping does something with his young lawyers. Part of the point of his training, I believe, is to have the lawyers really feel and respect their clients. It's client-centered representation is the phrasing they use. But what it really means is that you care about your clients and you think of them as people, not cases and not numbers. But the tragic irony is when you care that much, it's even more horrific to see what people are put through. And so that emotional part of being a defense lawyer is something I wanted to explore. And all the jobs where people are dealing with human problems, the people that we would want to be the most caring and supported, and often we are asking them to really do so much self-sacrifice to continue to do their work. And I think that that's a question for us as a society. You know, if we want to forge connections and encourage people to have human connections and empathy, then I think we really should be more supportive of work that draws on your empathy, you know, as part of its necessary skills. And most people now are becoming aware, or already aware, and probably your audience is aware, that America incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, We have between 2.2 and 2.3 million in prison or jails. So the United States has 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. So 1 in 4 people in prison or jail in the world is in America. We have the highest proportion of incarceration. And what you also see is that of the people who are arrested, who are brought into the system, 80% of them qualify for free legal counsel, which means 80% of the people coming into our system are poor. And then you add on to that that 95 to 97% of those people are pleading guilty. And when you say those statistics, those numbers are so high, one of the things you can do with film and radio is you can kind of slow things down and examine. None of us think that we would plead guilty to something we wouldn't do. It's inconceivable that you would willingly, quote unquote, subject yourself to punishment, and a really tough punishment for something you did not do. But I think you see that the way that the criminal justice system is organized and oriented, the rational thing is to plead guilty and get a sentence where you have a prayer of getting out. If you're charged and if you're convicted of armed robbery in Georgia, where Brandon was, it's 10 years to life. You can get life in prison for that crime. So if somebody gives you anything less than 10 years, it's really hard to turn that down and take your chances that a jury will believe you. So, you know, I think that poses a real moral question for our society, is what is appropriate punishment and how is it determined? If 95% of people do not have a trial by a jury of their peers, and then they're subject to minimum mandatory sentences, which prescribe the punishment, a minimum mandatory is a minimum mandatory. There's no credit for circumstances. We don't allow judges to be judges. So we're locking up a lot of people for a really long time. And there are severe implications for our society as a whole.
Guest documentary filmmaker Don Porter. UNI's Cloisi documentary film series will screen Don Porter's The Spies of Mississippi on October 6th.
When I was working at A&E Television, I was doing some work with History Channel, and one of the executives at History Channel was pitched this story to make it a television program. And they didn't have room for the story at History Channel, but he introduced me to a man named Rick Bowers, who wrote this wonderful young adult book with the same name. And Rick is a reporter and a journalist, and he kind of stumbled into the fact that in America, the largest domestic spy operation ever was conducted in Mississippi in the 1950s, and it was all set up to stop the civil rights movement. And when you think about that, it's astounding. And so we both just were kind of, the story just really captured our imagination. So History Channel passed on it, but I had told a lot of my friends at History Channel that I was thinking about doing my own documentary. So my colleagues kind of put us together and we set out on this adventure. So we went down to Jackson and he did some good old-fashioned reporting, and we found a man who we believe is Agent X. And one of the most shocking things is that it was African-Americans who were the undercover spy agents that were, you know, and it makes a lot of sense. If you're going to send somebody to infiltrate a civil rights meeting, you don't send, you know, J. Edgar Hoover. You send somebody who could be part of the movement. And what I love about this story so much is I think we're at a place in civil rights study and history where the memories are fuzzy. The people who were there are passing away. And we're taught civil rights history in a very neat box, you know. So there's slavery, and then this, you jump ahead to the civil rights movement, and then Martin Luther King comes, and, you know, all is well. And I think we can see from today's, you know, a lot of still troubles with race, all is not well. And I love, you know, history. I love documents. And so seeing that not only was there this spy agency, but the government kept all the records. So it's just this kind of treasure trove of information. And when you read the reports about the people who were conducting the spying, you get a real window into what it was like to live then. Whether you were white, black, or any nationality, if you were associating with civil rights activity, it could cost you your job, your livelihood, your social standing. And I think, you know, today we take for granted that the right thing to do is to talk about civil rights and how tolerant we are. But everybody who participated in the civil rights movement, no matter how small their activity, was really a target of domestic spying sanctioned by the government. And I think that that's a really important fact to remember as we have contemporary debates about what level of privacy we have and how we enforce laws against people who speak up against government action that they disagree with. So I actually started that film before Gideon's Army, but it was really hard to find funding for it. So we shot and I got like little bits of grants here and there. And then at some point I got the money to make Gideon's Army. So I made that. And then while that was in process and I was in kind of the documentary community, I was able to find, I first found a German partner, which was great. So the film aired and was very successful in Germany. They like spy stories in Germany. And then public television here, Independent Lens, showed the film here. And so I'm really, really proud of that because it was part of a great documentary strand. And, you know, I was just really glad that that story got out too. So they're very, very different films and different styles. And I really like that too. As a filmmaker, it's fun to be able to do different kinds of things.
The University of Northern Iowa's Cloacy documentary film series is bringing Dawn Porter to Iowa for the screening and discussion of two of her films. Gideon's Army will be screened on October 5th and Spies of Mississippi on the 6th. Both films are free and open to the public and will be shown at 7 p.m. at UNI's Lang Hall Auditorium. You can also hear more of Dawn's interview at iowapublicradio.org by clicking on the Iowa Art Showcase under the Classical drop-down menu. The 2015 Blackhawk Chamber Music Festival runs October 10th through the 19th. For more details, go to bhcmf.org. Just ahead, Iowa State University's theater and music departments team up to produce Mozart's The Magic Flute. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
It's absolutely amazing that we are able to put on this production at the level that we're going to put it on with an orchestra and a cast that is almost entirely comprised of undergraduate students. They work really hard and they're super talented kids. We couldn't do it without them.
And indeed, my experience sitting in an auditions, I was absolutely flabbergasted by the high quality of the singing and the acting, the preparation of the students. My colleagues here in theater have been superb throughout. So we're really blessed with a team of players, if you will, in music, in the cast, with Jody and with Jacob and the production staff, the costume designer, the lighting designer, the technical director in the theater, and even the administrator. And everyone has been incredibly helpful and also expert all the way through.
It's wonderful to work with these colleagues. I get to do this every third year and get to spend time with Jody and to be getting to know and working with Leslie and such an amazing group in the theater area. From the orchestra side, the chamber orchestra is made up of students from music majors, of course, many music majors, but also fields in engineering and the sciences and the arts and other areas. And these are just amazing kids. And they come in and they work so hard and they are really doing just beautiful, beautiful playing already, and I'm so excited about our production that's coming up.
Iowa State University's Department of Music faculty vocal coach and the opera's music director, Jody Goble. Guest theater director and associate professor from the University of Kansas, Leslie Bennett. And ISU's director of orchestral activities, including the ISU Symphony and Chamber Orchestra, Dr. Jacob Harrison. Every 3 years, ISU's theater and music departments join forces to produce a full-scale opera. This year, they are presenting Mozart's The Magic Flute with over 75 ISU students participating. Leslie fills us in on some history behind Mozart's The Magic Flute.
This opera was commissioned by Emanuel Schikaneder. He actually wrote the libretto and conceived the role of Papageno as a vehicle for himself. He and Mozart collaborated on this fairy tale together, and they also embedded some of the ideals, goals, and principles, values of the Masons, and they were both Masons.
And it's a very late work. It's not exactly an opera. It's a singspiel, so it has spoken dialogue. But we think of it as an opera because the musical numbers in it are reminiscent of opera. They're in the same style, and it's the last one that Mozart completed.
And not only is it a very famous opera, but the overture is considered one of the ultimate overtures for opera of all time.
Absolutely. It's one of the great, great overtures that were written. Mozart has many, many famous overtures, and the writing for the orchestra is just sparkles, and it's brilliant, brilliant writing.
And it starts out with a slow intro, and then it has these triple chords. What are these triple chords all about?
Well, I think throughout the opera you'll find all sorts of references to threes, and that, of course, is getting back to the Masons and getting back to this sort of secret society that they were a part of.
You find that in the characterization, too, that there are groups of threes. There are three ladies who are the handmaids of the Queen of the Night. There are three spirits who are these sort of benevolent characters who shepherd the main characters through their emotional journey. Three is actually a great number in opera. Three voices singing together is almost always incredibly beautiful. So I'm not sure whether Mozart was thinking in terms of the vocal properties of the trio or whether it was a Masonic number thing, but in any case, it works really well.
And throughout the opera, there are other trios that happen as well. There was a trio with Zoroastro and Pamina and Tamino, and I'm trying to think of some of the
There's
other ones.
There's a scene between Anastatos and Papageno and Pamina.
That's right. And also that there is an overall principle of music, which is that there can be no harmony without dissonance. And all the way through this opera, we have pairs. So not just threes, but we have Zoroastro, who is the ruler of the sun, and the queen of the night, who is the star-blazing queen. And we have some of the characters. We have Tamino and Papageno, who are both sort of archetypes of human beings, you know, and one of them is leaning more toward spiritual attainment, and the other one is a very earthy kind of human being who longs for more earthly joy, more earthly pleasure, who finds his spirituality in that realm. There are numerous other cases, but all the way through the opera, we have this sense of kind of yin and yang, and the idea of balance and restoring harmony to something that is out of balance. And that's what we get finally when, at the end of the opera, after Pamino and Tamino make it through all of their trials and basically take the place of Zoroastro and the queen, I think.
This opera is known for some very major roles that people know about. So outline for us some of the major players in this opera and then some of the arias that they sing.
Well, I'm sure that to an audience that is unfamiliar with opera, the one piece of music from this opera that will be immediately recognizable is the Queen of the Night's Vengeance aria from Act Two. And it's famous because it's so very demanding for the soprano. It's a coloratura soprano role, and she has to sing six high Fs. So this is not the F at the top of the staff. It's the F one octave higher than that in the soprano's whistle range. It's a high F for a flute to play, actually.
So high F above high C.
High F above high C, yeah. And this particular piece of music is used all over pop culture, and it's instantly recognizable to kindergartners. If you play it for them, they've heard it. So it's an example of a very virtuosic role that's sort of embedded in our ears going in.
And to counterbalance that, we have Zoroastro's arias, and he's opposite to the Queen of the Night. And so his aria is really famous for actually descending down to it might be a low F, right?
There is a low F in one of them, yes.
And really, truly magical counterbalance between those two roles.
What has occurred to me is that this particular show is broken up so evenly between the different factions of the cast. It's an ensemble cast in the truest sense of the word, because you can't do it with two stars and then a bunch of lesser singers. You really need 40 really good singers, which is what we have. It's one of those operas that you can only program when you absolutely have the right talent to do it, which is one of the things that makes it so exciting.
So why is the Magic Flute such an important opera?
Well, it's sort of a soundtrack for the human condition. There's a little bit of something for everyone. I think we read fairy tales to make ourselves more knowledgeable about human behavior. And we go to the opera to see our own motivations and weaknesses and strengths made larger, not only by the action on the stage, but also amplified by the music itself. And the Magic Flute does this really well on all levels. If you don't know what any of the words mean, even if you're seeing it in German and you don't know what anyone's saying, you're still going to appreciate it as a flawlessly sublime piece of music. And when you add the characters and the story to it, it's hard to think of another piece of music theater that's as charming and all-encompassing and easy to identify with. And we have a strong history of selling out, and there are only 4 productions. So, especially for good seats, I would recommend that you buy early. Also, on the Friday night performance, it runs Thursday through Sunday, and Sunday is a matinee. But before the Friday performance, Simon Estes, who is an artist in residence at Iowa State, will be giving a talk, a presentation before the performance as sort of a little extra. He's going to be talking about his experiences singing the role of Zoroastro in international opera houses around the world, which should be fascinating to hear his experiences with that.
Iowa State University's Department of Music faculty vocal coach and the opera's music director, Jody Goebel. Guest theater director and associate professor from the University of Kansas, Leslie Bennett. And ISU's director of orchestral activities, Dr. Jacob Harrison. ISU's production of Mozart's The Magic Flute will be fun for kids of all ages. Performances will be held on November 5th through the 8th at the Fisher Theater on the ISU campus in Ames. Tickets for the general public are available through the Iowa State Center ticket office and all Ticketmaster locations. For more information, please go to theater.iastate.edu/the-magic-flute. And don't forget to listen for Iowa Public Radio's Opera in October series starting tonight and tomorrow afternoon on Iowa Public Radio Classical. Today's October Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Ann Crevero, Jessica Anderson, Robert McConnell, Charles Swanson, William and Trilligator, Don Porter, Jody Goebel, Leslie Bennett, and Jacob Harrison. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner, Jason Burns, Jim Davies, and KQED. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR Sean McLean and Music Director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo and Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.